Hi, I'm Allison Hess.
And I'm Stephanie Graham.
Welcome to the Thousand Islands Playhouse Podcast. We have seven amazing shows to dive into for our 2024 season.
Join us as we talk to the artists that will make this season shine and get a behind-the-scenes peek at what's happening this summer dockside.
Don't forget to tune in
to give your ears a front row seat.
See you at the theater.
Welcome back to the 2024 season of the Playhouse Podcast. We're recording today on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg peoples, and we are recording on site at the Fire Hall Theater. My name is Allison Hess, and I'm the Education and Engagement Manager.
And I am Stephanie Graham, and I am the Artistic Associate here at the Playhouse. Welcome to the fourth episode of the 2024 season at the Playhouse Podcast. Today, we are talking about the brilliant, romantic, and historical dream play, Mary's Wedding. Mary's Wedding is a Canadian play written by Stephen Massicott, set during the First World War, that tells the story of Mary and her first love, Charlie. From the blossoming of their relationship on the vast Alberta prairies to the bloody battlefields of France, the story captures a time of innocence and courage with rare sensitivity and beauty. Mary's Wedding is an epic, unforgettable story of love, hope, and survival.
Mary's Wedding was last performed at the Playhouse in 2006 in the Fire Hall Theatre. It's back this season on the Springer stage, directed by Managing Artistic Director Brett Christopher. And we're very lucky to have Mary and Charlie themselves in the studio today, Mev Beattie and Wade Bogart O'Brien.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Yay. Mev and Wade, this is both of your debuts at the Playhouse, but you've worked at theaters all over Ontario and beyond. Mev, you've spent eight seasons at the Stratford Festival performing in many shows, but some highlights, Much Ado About Nothing, Hamlet, Death and the King's Horseman, and as well as theaters all over such as Soulpepper, Past Mirai, Tarragon, and Canadian Stage. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And Wade, listeners would have seen you at the Shaw in St. Joan, Mrs. Warren's Profession, and Pygmalion, as well as productions at YPT, Drayton, The Citadel out in Alberta, and the North American premiere of Chariots of Fire that we worked on together at the Grand Theatre in London.
Oh,
so welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Such a small world. Yeah.
It really is.
Well, we're so happy to have you both in town and to be performing on the Springer with this beautiful Canadian play. So thank you so much. Now, so for those that don't know, they call Mary's Wedding a dream play. And as Charlie states, the play begins at the end and ends at the beginning. And so it's not quite as straightforward as other experiences that people might have had at the theater. How do you as actors approach this type of material that moves sometime unexpectedly through space and time? And how do you keep yourself grounded in your characters?
I think teamwork has a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of play I love to do because there's so much space for us to collaborate and fill in Stephen's beautiful vision. So I can already tell Wade and I haven't had the pleasure of working together before, but I'm already like, oh, yay, an animal that I recognize because it's, well, we could do it this way. We could do it this way. What if we want it to be clear for the audience's head, but also for their hearts? And so we want to find a clear way through to share the story, but clear doesn't necessarily mean straightforward. Mm-hmm. Clear doesn't necessarily mean linear. Mm-hmm. And so I can tell that we are going to build with Brett and the rest of the creative team a way through that has as much in it as possible, but as clearly shared as possible, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And I feel like what's been exciting in these last 3 days, I guess, we're kind of just figuring out how to do that. We're trying to figure out how we're navigating as actors and as the characters, and how the characters are what their experience is navigating this non-linear story. And in terms of the audience, are kind of experiencing it in the time of the play and not in the time of these characters' lives. Mm-hmm. Not in the chronology of the characters' lives, but in the chronology of the play. So that's been a cool discovery to be like, oh yeah, I just know what has happened in the play in the same way that the audience only knows what's happened so far.
And I think just lots of discovery. And I think there'll be discovery, the pleasure of doing a play that has this much richness and in a space like this, in a theater of this size, and an intimate size theater where we can really feel the people at the back, is that it's going to be a collaborative discovery the whole time. So the people who come, I think, in opening week will have as rich but varied experience for the people who come at the end, because we're going to be discovering things all the way through. And the beauty is that the narration that is shared really between the two characters is also discovering the whole time. So that's never going to take away from what we're trying to offer, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I love that.
Typically, Mary's wedding is staged with Mary's present being only a few years after she first meets Charlie. Can you tell us a bit about how this production changes that?
Well, yes. It's really fun because Brett asked me to do the show, and you can't tell on a podcast, maybe, but I'm not 22. And the actresses that usually play this part, and this play, we have to say, this play has been done everywhere. It is really one of the most successful Canadian two-hander plays in the history of Canadian theater, like The Drawer Boy, like any of these other plays. That it's the kind of play that you study in theater school for generations to come, because you're like, what is it that's uniquely Canadian and uniquely theatrical and a unique offering about this? So we, I feel like all of us who work in theater know about this play, and you've either seen it or we certainly know of lots of productions. So when Brett asked me to do it, I laughed because I said, you know, I'm new spring chicken, and the play is often an opportunity for two ingenue actors, a male and female ingenue actor. But I love that Stephen, the playwright, and Brett were interested in exploring the effects of heartbreak, grief, and war, and trauma in a real life way about healing and repair. Now, we say those four words and you think, oh, I was going to go see it, but that sounds kind of bleak, which I get. But the play is so tremendously full of life and love. Mm. And that gift to reimagine the play for Stephen and for Brett is to say, okay, one thing that always I thought curious about the play, and I think was true generationally at the time, in terms of war widows or the war brides that never got to be, that were married or engaged and then never got to see that wedding happen, is that some of those women, when the boys came back, when it was all over, okay, we've got to keep this going. We have to remarry. We have to have children. We'll get married right away. But a lot were too grief-stricken or full of loss or confused. And there was a whole generation of women who didn't get married until later and who didn't have children until later. And so the opportunity to explore that with this production is a huge gift, because my grandmother was very lucky. My grandpa did come back and they did go on to have four kids, but that was a World War II, of course. But I think often about the fact that she was older when she started that whole journey and what that meant for her knowledge of the world. And I think that loans something really real and relatable in 2024, in fact, to grief and heartbreak and women aging. Yeah.
I've had a very similar experience to Mev when I got the audition. My agent sent me out the audition for this, and I said, I think they think I'm younger than I am. Because it happens to me sometimes, because, you know, people might have a relationship with your work from before, and they don't remember that that was 10, 15 years ago. So I almost didn't send in the tape, because the first round was a tape, and I thought, I'm not going to get cast in this. I'm too old now to play this role. I love the... But then I thought, I like the scene and it will be fun to just do the scene with my wife in my living room, and then I'll and then I'll just do it for that reason. And it wasn't a big ask, that audition. So I did it, and then I got a call back, and that's when they said, oh, and Mev's playing. And I was like, oh. And then I was really excited to possibly work with Mev, whose work I really admire. And it's fun to, with these plays that everyone has a relationship with,
to see it through a new lens.
Yeah, because really there's such a there can be baggage in people's imaginations
and expectations.
This is what this play is, and it's so great to get to do it in a way where you can just say, "Oh, but it's not that." So we kind of have this amazing opportunity to see the play through a different lens, and also to discover the play for the first time in a way. I think it adds richness, I guess I should say, to certain parts of the play, or adds a different texture to certain parts of the play, and to Mary's experience, and to also to Charlie's experience, if there's a little more distance from the war.
I think There's something about a play that has a lot of innocence in it, being played by people who are themselves coming across as innocent, is just different than a play mm-hmm. that is talking about innocence from someone who's seen both sides. It's very much the Joni Mitchell song, this production, you know. And I know that it's going to therefore appeal to multi-generations, because I know that a lot of our beloved audience is a bit older, and maybe my age or older, and that's just a different set of goggles. And yet, the younger people we have on the team, I can see them adding and having insights into the love story and the meet cute of the first meetings that is legit, because it's maybe being experienced by them as well. It's a privilege. And, you know, I remember doing Hamlet at Stratford a couple seasons ago, and we were in first day of rehearsal, and Anthony was not, I'm directing it, but Anthony Cimolino, who runs Stratford, came in and he said this great thing. He said, "I've got some good news. There's no good way to do Hamlet." He's like, "You can't get it right. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is not to have it be right. The point is to have it be real."
And that's so freeing as an artist.
It's beautiful. And I reminded myself of that today. Of, we don't have to get the play right, because we know the play works. It's been done so many times. We just have to make it ours and make it real.
Yeah. I love that. I think probably this is true of a lot of actors. I struggled a lot as a young actor, being like, I wanted to make the right choice, you know?
Right.
So I would do all this thinking and then try and decide what I thought, and then I'd stick to it. You know, even if I was running something for 100 performances, I would do it that way, because it was, that's the right way to say the line, and that's the right choice that makes the most sense. And this is clearly what the author intended. As I got older, it was like, oh, that, partly from having made some objectively wrong choices and having stuck with them for a bit too long. Like, oh, I guess there is no right way to do a play. It is, as you're saying, Steph, it's so freeing.
I do think when you get, it happened to me too, and there's like a point in your maturation as a career actor where you're like, oh, that's the opposite. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite, actually. I thought... Which is funny, because if you're a good student actor, and I think, you know, in musical theater especially, like athletes of musical theater, they do have to hit their marks. They do have to hit their choreo, or someone's going to get hurt, or you're going to hit the wrong note.
But I think there's still freedom in those scene work too.
Hugely.
And I think that's something that you're both speaking to, is like, as you grow as an actor and an artist, like realizing that it will never be right. It's about the investigation. It's about that moment. Mm-hmm. It's every day coming in and trying to look for the truth in that moment. And
like, that's the beauty of live theater too, right? If we wanted to see the same thing every time in the same way, we just pop in a DVD or find something streaming. And so having, you know, you bringing something new to this play, you know, Stephen and Brett bringing something new to this play, I think is a really special thing. What are the kind of logistical changes that you've made to not age up the play, but, you know, to sort of have that distance and that sense of like looking back that might be different from other productions that people have seen?
At the moment, I think I would say, ironically, it's the opposite, is the feeling that was something that was required, that I thought, okay, we've got to figure out what our take on this is, because the casting is not how it's been. And it just, it's actually already done.
Casting
is what it is, and we are who we are.
And then you just approach it.
I don't have to add a lens of nostalgia, because I'm walking through the world as one. I've got, you know, I've got a about to be 11-year-old child, and I've got 30 years in the industry under me, and I see the world differently than I did. And even being on the other side and understanding that we both have had that epiphany at some point of, no, the point is to be alive, is already where the ground is laid for, you know, the hard work. Which the important thing about that too is, for anybody who's listening, is to understand how much we rely on the audience, and how that will not happen until the audience is with us, and that we understand how they're, and the beauty of a play like this is that we cannot do it without the audience. The audience, in fact, we've talked about that, I think, artistically and creatively in the process, but the witnessing from the audience, being there with us for this particular story. In some shows, you do feel like, I could get up and go and get a bag of chips and come back and I wouldn't be missed. We're going to miss you if you go get chips. Luckily, it's not a long show.
No, there's so much to invest in, too, with these two characters, I think. I mean, rereading it, I was thinking even about again, this different casting choice of how that manifests memory. So even just for both of you, with this beautiful poetic language, how does that invoke memories for you as artists or as the characters or anything like that?
I feel like there's a real truth in the way Stephen is writing about memory and in writing about grief. To me, it really, even though some of it is like magic realism, it really feels real to me. And it really feels truthful to me, the way that he writes about how people remember things or how people sometimes remember things that they didn't even see. And to me, in my life, that feels very true, that, you know, there are things I feel like I know that I can't possibly know, you know, the things I feel like I've seen that I did not see and I did not witness, but feel very real to me in my imagination. And that there, for me, there is a truth in those thoughts or those imagined realities that is maybe not the literal truth.
And there's a lot in this particular play, it happens to be about World War I, so there's a before and an after. And I feel like right now we know, everyone knows a before and an after right now, specifically the pandemic. So I think everybody has right now a visceral feeling of what it was like before we had a global shutdown and after, and that will mean something completely different for every individual. Stephen just is speaking to something that morally, you know, the right and the wrong thing to do, what's good for me as a person, what's good for my heart, what's good for my love story versus what's good for my community. You know, all of these questions are, I think, front of mind and front of heart for a lot of people right now. And so the fact that that is 100 years ago is great.
Yeah.
Because we're just all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And how you balance, you know, this is a personal story about two people, but it's also about this very large, very well-known event that affected millions of people. And is there a balance that you find, or do you just focus on the characters and the personal and hope that it reads in a universal way? Like, how do you approach that?
Well, I think Stephen has done so much of that work that our job is just to come with it with as much fullness as possible, because I am consistently moved and amazed by his ability to... It's his poetry or description or ability to take us somewhere very specific environment, very quickly and not even for very long. And I think, you know, we have a real interest in World War films. You know, we have a real interest in excellent cinema that can recreate that. But I'm like, when you can do that with words and situation and character, it's pretty great. It's what I prefer because I think it sticks longer. I mean, you know, if we are partially conjuring and participating in conjuring what he's given us as the audience, as well as the performers, it's going to stick more so that we'll see it everywhere. Hopefully there'll be, it's the kind of play where you leave and you're going to see and feel things everywhere after, and it'll change. Oh yeah, that. And in this part of the world, in like Thousand Islands, and I grew, you know, I was a teenager in Kingston, and you know, a lot of that military structure that's in that history of that place is just part of the story of living in that place. So he's done that. Yeah.
I think in a way those two things are almost the same too. Like, he tries to give us a little glimpse into what it felt like, what some of these moments felt like to people, what it felt like to be in the trenches, and in the poetry that Mev's talking about and the descriptions. And as Mev's saying, in a very different way than you would experience by seeing a realistic depiction of something on the screen, that it's more that you're in the room with the person who's going through that thing, you know? And that's the way I hope we can honor that history, is by us imagining what it feels like, and hopefully helping the audience to imagine what it feels like, what it felt like.
One of the devices Stephen uses is letter writing. And of course, those are incredible primary source historical documents that we have from the Great Wars. Were you, either of you, letter writers back in the day?
Ooh, I love that.
Oh my God, you've asked such a sweet question, and I have such a sad answer. but that's kind of the way I roll. But I had a boyfriend all through university. for many years, and he was actually a boy who went to high school, the same high school as me in Kingston. He passed away a couple of years ago, and he was really, you know, my first love, and for many years. And his sister recently sent me back my letters.
Oh, that's incredible.
And so I received them in a package, and he had kept them. And there were a couple in there that were like a note, where I had run out to get, I was like, you know, hey, babe, run out to get coffee. Mm-hmm. Please do the blah, blah. Sure. I love you so much. And I was like, oh, he kept that. So to have those back is amazing, because, you know, there's also something in this play where if it's your first love, that person knows a you that nobody else knows, mm-hmm. not even you. So it's the first person maybe to love you outside of your parents. And so it's, in this case, that boyfriend was someone who knew me as basically a teenager mm-hmm. into a young adult. So for someone who watches you go through those changes, they hold a version of you in them that is private.
Right.
So the letters, they hold that in them. And it was like meeting, you know, meeting yourself again, and just incredible.
What a gift.
Yeah.
That's what a beautiful gift.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always been a letter writer. Less so recently.
That does not surprise me.
but I used to, like, even in theater school, over the summer, I'd send my classmates letters. Jen and I, my wife, and I have all written letters, like, when, as actors, my wife's an actor as well, you spend a lot of time apart doing contracts out of town or whatever. So I would always write her letters, and I used to do this thing where I just buy random objects from like the grocery store, the dollar store, and put stamps on them and write a letter, and like on an orange or a can of soup, just to see if it would get there. And it always does, by the way. If you put enough stamps on anything, sometimes they put it in a plastic bag and deliver it, but
go Canada Post.
And I used to do like make origamis and put stamps on them and write letters. Oh, wow. And all this stuff. And she wrote me back too, all the time. So I have all her letters that she wrote me still in a drawer, and she has all the.
She has the orange.
Not the orange, but she has all the little origamis, and I don't do it as much as I used to.
It truly is a lost art now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everything electronic.
Yeah.
That's such another amazing way to connect to the story. So we always love to finish up our podcasts every time with just, you know, asking about your time in Gananoque. And we call it again shout out, because a community such as this really depends. Everyone depends on each other, and we support each other. So we always love to do a little shout out. And the question is, like, have you been to any spots in the last couple of days, or are there places that you're really looking forward to checking out? You know, whether it's a business or a restaurant or the river, you know, where have you been or where are you wanting to go?
I was on my way home a couple of days ago on the bike.
Oh, yeah.
That was lent to me by the theater, which is so wonderful. Freedom. And I popped into Pistachio, and I was like, oh, I'm going to bring my daughter here. I'm going to spend some time here. It's such a lovely little gift of a place. I have to say, I'm determined to check out every business in Gan, because it feels possible. It feels like you can actually hit them all before the end of a contract, which is exciting. But Pistachio Gelato is on the to-do list for this weekend, for sure.
Yes. For sure. Good gelato there.
I hear.
My first night here, my wife and I ordered the large Greco's special pizza.
Yes.
Greco's, which was amazing. I loved it in there. It's like a real pizza place, which I feel like, oddly, it's one of the things that we've lost in Toronto.
Mm.
We have great pizza in Toronto, but it's fancy. And then you have the chains, but you don't have just the like
family good, run.
Yeah, family yeah. run. Like that just doesn't exist in Toronto anymore, because probably people can't afford to do it anymore, unfortunately. So that was really special and delicious.
Yeah. And they have great pizza, great burgers,
and
subs as well.
Cool.
Well, their food's all delicious. So yeah, amazing. Both two really great places, and actually across the street from each other.
That's true.
So
yes,
if listeners are feeling hungry, they can
have a burger and then a gelato afterwards.
Yeah.
After the theater or before.
I love that. I want to thank you both for coming and talking with us, and kind of joining us at the beginning of your journey through this experience, which is exciting. And then when this podcast is released and people are listening to it and they get to come see the show, they're going to kind of see you kind of midway through. So I'm excited to kind of check in, you know, once we open and see how things are going. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.
We're so excited. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful show.
It's going to be wonderful.
Thank you, as always, to Mark Hunt for composing the music for the Playhouse podcast. For more ticket information, please visit us at thousandislandsplayhouse.com. See you at the theater!